Kevin.
Hi, Kelly. Sorry about that.
Oh, no worries. So in the next half hour, we will be discussing a fun grab bag of topics, and we're hoping you'll be able to take away at least a couple of interesting science stories to share with your friends this week. So, as I was researching tonight's topic, one thing I was struck by is this idea that there really is no such thing as a breakthrough, that the idea of scientific discovery almost seems kind of oxymoronic in a way. A breakthrough is something, in my experience, where you're able to get a plasmid assembled or something something very banal, like, yes, I can do more work.
You know, I already left work, Kelly. I don't need any more of
that. Oh, you can never leave. or when your lab gets grant money or something like that, like the things that sort of allow us to move further. But
yeah, the really boring things that nobody really cares about. Yeah.
Have you ever had, do you feel like you've ever had a breakthrough or a discovery moment?
I have, although I have to admit that a lot of them, after I put my arms in the air, I just punched the mic.
Hachi machi, cha cha cha.
I was demonstrating a little bit too viscerally. After I throw my hands in the air in excitement, I often find out that I'm looking at a negative control or something, and it's actually not what I expected, and then I'm forlorn.
And that's a discovery.
That's the unfortunate type of discovery, but yes.
Well, I don't think it's unfortunate at all. I think, in fact, a lot of scientific discoveries are kind of made that way, where it doesn't really make sense what you're seeing.
Oh, totally.
Right?
It's accidents.
It's an accident. It's a lateral thinking problem. It's more like connecting two dots that weren't connected. But, like, you kind of knew that they were both there, at least that this was a possibility. It's never like, whoa, I didn't expect this to ever in a million years happen. So one of the, and again, science is a messy process. So tonight, for this first segment, I'm going to be talking about the discovery of phosphorus.
Dun, dun, dun.
You excited yet?
I'm excited.
So excited. How do you discover an element that you're made of? Right? I mean, somebody had to discover oxygen. Somebody had to discover these things.
I assume you're asking rhetorically.
What is discovery? What is discovery? Help. I don't know what this means. So tonight I'm going to tell you a little bit about phosphorus. You may know phosphorus from such tables as the periodic table of elements.
Celebrated a monumental birthday. I don't remember what year it is, but it's like one of the big ones, like 200 or something.
Yes. Yeah. We'll get into that.
Okay.
For sure. Pause. So phosphorus. Where else have we heard of phosphorus before?
I should know, but I don't.
So biochemically, phosphorus is the basis for all life on our planet in a lot of ways. Adult humans contain approximately 0.7 kilograms of phosphorus, mainly in the bones and teeth, as calcium phosphate salts. At the molecular level, the polynucleotide structures DNA and RNA, you might know
I knew that
from
one.
Genes, contains the phosphodiester bridges that link one nucleotide to the next. Also, ATP, are you down with the primary carrier of energy in the cells? So these high-energy phosphate bonds are really important for allowing biochemical reactions and catalysis to happen. So ATP is one of them. There's also a whole other set of those that are important for signaling and a lot of other things. We won't bore you with that right now. The other reason you might know phosphorus is phospholipids. So every cell in your body is chock full of it. It's attached to these. It's a type of fatty acid that's found in membranes and beyond. It's ubiquitous, but it's attached to lipids, it's energy, it's all these wonderful things. So you might also, have you ever had a garden?
I have had gardens. I have a garden that's buried under snow right now.
Oh, goodness. So yeah. You're probably not going to be applying fertilizer anytime soon.
Probably not.
But eventually, we do know that phosphorus is important for plant growth. Plants get phosphorus from the soil, right?
Okay.
Some of this is bacterial. Some of this is the result of microbes in the soil. A lot of this is breakdown of older, like fossils and things like that. So early aquatic life, such as seashells, eventually were buried on the seafloor and transferred to the lithosphere via mineralization and tectonic uplift over millions of years. Those eventually weathered down via wind and rain erosion, and now they're back to being a usable form of phosphorus in the soil.
Wow, that's quite the scenic route of the circle of life.
I know, it's right. So it's what comes around goes around.
Yeah.
So phosphorus is a element of particular concern. It is problematic if we don't have a way for life to access phosphorus. So Isaac Asimov, in a 1974 essay called Life's Bottleneck, described how phosphorus is an essential chemical contained in all living organisms. Quote, life can multiply until all the phosphorus is gone, and then there is an inexorable halt which nothing can prevent. We may be able to substitute nuclear power for coal, plastics for wood, yeast for meat, friendliness for isolation, but for phosphorus, there is neither substitute nor replacement.
Wow, I love that the friendliness is just thrown in with all of those other, like, tangible material science things.
That's Asimov for you.
Oh, okay.
So we have too many phosphates in some places and not enough in others, and so we're worried about how we can maintain this phosphorus cycle in Earth. So phosphorus has a cycle. It's an important cycle, like the carbon cycle or the nitrogen cycle you might have heard of. So phosphorus is one of these, so we need to get a handle on that. But I digress. This is partially taken from A Brief History of Phosphorus, from the Philosopher's Stone to Nutrient Recovery and Reuse. It's a review by Ashley et al. So, how do you discover something that you're already made of? In 1669, in his Hamburg basement laboratory, German merchant Henning Brandt distilled 50 buckets of urine through intense heating and distillation in search of the legendary Philosopher's Stone that would supposedly turn base metals into gold. Henning was born to modest social standing and developed a curiosity about the world through which various trade jobs he worked. Accounts from the time don't go into detail about where Brand got his raw material or what his basement smelled like.
Right.
But they do suggest that Brand stockpiled something like 1,500 gallons of urine in his quest for the Philosopher's Stone. One surviving account of the process begins, quote, take a good large quantity of new-made urine of beer drinkers, then evaporate it gently to the consistency of honey.
Uh-huh.
He did so to derive a waxy white substance that glowed gently in the dark.
Wow.
And he did this by heating the residues from the boiled-down urine in his furnace until red hot, where all of a sudden glowing fumes filled it, and the liquid dripped out, bursting into flames. He could catch the liquid in a jar and cover it, where it solidified and continued to give off a pale green glow. What he collected was phosphorus, which he named from the Greek word for light-bearing. He did include a recipe, but it's a little too gross for me to read on the air. Some of you guys might be eating something.
Yeah.
So what's interesting about this to me is in the early Middle Ages, physicians, quote unquote, treated illnesses ineffectually with herbs and plant extracts. I mean, to some extent, we heard last week about some ways that that plague doctors were able to use herbs successfully in a way to kind of address working with the sick. But what's interesting here is that this is an example of where chemical use became a form of medicine as opposed to herbs, which seem to be more like holistic and earthy.
Right.
So unfortunately, Henning did not find the Philosopher's Stone capable of transmutation. But this phosphorus that he discovered interacts with oxygen, and that's kind of what gives it this unearthly glue. And they found use for this. This was actually like very exciting for them. So a lot of doctors tried to find a way to use this. Let's see.
Can I ask you then?
Sure.
Is this where phosphorescence comes from?
Is it
named after phosphorus?
Because yes. Of
so I didn't know that element had like this sort of inherent glow to it. I mean, I'm familiar with phosphorescence, which is where glow-in-the-dark materials...
Right.
What they're doing, right?
So exactly.
It's like a relaxation
of high
energy electrons, essentially.
Yes.
Sort of, right?
But in the case of this phosphorus, it was more of a chemical reaction and less of a capture and release, I think.
Interesting.
Because I don't think glow in the dark shirts are like oxidizing like that.
Okay.
So he eventually sold his invention, and other people kind of got credit for it for a while, one of whom was the German alchemist Johann Knuckel, who created pills. He was a German apothecary, and he created pills containing 200 milligrams of yellow phosphorus protected from the atmosphere by a surface layer of gold or silver. And he prescribed this for treating colic, asthmatic fevers, tetanus, apoplexy, and gout. However, a fatal dose of phosphorus can be as low as 1 milligram per kilogram body mass.
Oh, that's not a lot.
He called... those look like very fancy pills, and I could understand why they would be very attractive. So this is just... I mean, they're trying things. This is how science works. Yep. You know, maybe there is a chance. It was also later on used to treat things like tuberculosis. And among other things, eventually phosphorus sort of lost its reputation as a pharmaceutical, and it became of more interest as a weapon of war, as something that can be used for munitions. And then it kind of became important for the Green Revolution, for use in fertilizers and for use in food systems. The sources of phosphorus that we use for, you know, the various manufacturing processes of today also kind of shifted. So we talked about it coming from urine at first. It was discovered then that night soil or defecation, like waste, like solid waste, was another great way to produce phosphorus. Or from bones, bone ash is another way. There's actually a picture, a really famous picture of a guy standing on top of a pile of bison skulls, bison that were killed off from the those skulls were burnt down to make phosphorus.
Really?
For munitions and matches and things like that.
Only.
That's what the citation said.
This element really gets around.
It really does. Yeah. So from its discovery, from its, you know, admittedly very humble beginnings, we see it takes quite a trip through the apothecary, through munitions, through fertilizer. And again, we've talked about how this is important for food systems and global balances. But this is science, you know, like you discover something that's already there. Right. And you sort of start figuring out, well, what else does it do? Where else does it show up? What other cool things can we do with this?
I would say out of the range of scientific discoveries that I've heard of or you know, genesis of scientific information, the narrative arc from urine to food nutrient is a pretty good one.
It is.
If I had to pick a narrative arc for my discoveries. I mean,
yeah.
Then again, there's a lot of room for improvement from urine, I suppose.
It makes sense, you know, right? Like if you didn't know any better, like it's not a super bad idea to think that there's something beautiful hidden in like human bodily fluids or humors, right? It's just a matter of figuring out how you can get to it, right? So you heat it up a lot and you see what happens. And I mean, could you imagine being there to see this distillate glowing in the dark?
Yeah, that's so incredible.
Oh my goodness. Like, talk about discoveries.
We're practically fireflies at that point, right? Just a couple steps away.
A beautiful sentiment.
Yeah.
Kevin, are you ready for a game?
Oh God.
Do you want to play a game?
This sounds like the start of a horror movie. Yes, I'm going to go with
yes. All right. This is called. So I don't have a name for this bit.
Okay.
I should.
It's
I usually do.
Bit.
It's the game bit.
It's the gambit.
The heading is grabbing pills, but that's a pretty obscure Left 4 Dead reference. So I'm going to, again, with this idea of science sort of being this messy, circuitous path, I'm going to ask you a question I'm going to name some kind of a medicine, and it's something that probably most people will recognize, and I'm going to see if you can tell me where it originated.
Okay, where in terms of
how it was discovered. So, for example, Novocaine.
Uh-huh.
We know what Novocaine does now.
Yeah, with the teeth and the shots.
Local numbing, usually associated with dental practice.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't developed for that initially. Where did it come from?
Oh, that's a good question.
I'll give you a hint.
Yeah,
Novocaine.
Like cane sugar? No. It can't be it.
Cain
and Abel. I'm just going to keep word playing my way through this. No, I don't know.
commonly used anesthetic is actually named for the drug cocaine.
No.
Cocaine was first introduced as a local anesthetic in 1884, but it caused a number of addictions and death.
Oh, well.
A few years later, German chemist Alfred Einhorn began to look for a safer substitute, and in 1905, he discovered the injectable local anesthetic procaine, which became Novocaine.
Wow.
How about that? All right, ready for another one?
Yeah, I'll try to not make biblical references this time.
You can make a Nirvana reference, because this is lithium. Lithium is used to manage mood disorders like bipolar disorder. Where it came from?
So I always thought it had to do with psychiatric disorders in terms of its medicinal form.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine another use for it.
Before it received FDA approval in 1970, the metal was used in the 1840s to treat bladder stones and gout.
How?
What? Gosh, Kevin, I don't know. Why did people do anything?
But how,
that's kind of the story of old-timey medicine, isn't it?
How are those things possibly linked? That blows my mind. Okay. I'm 0 for 2.
A century later, an Australian physicist observed that guinea pigs injected with a form of lithium became sedated rather than excited. Subsequent large-scale clinical studies confirmed lithium's effectiveness for preventing mania.
Wow.
How did that? I don't even know how those connect.
Well, now I'm wondering what other places in guinea pigs we can inject lithium to see medicinal value.
Discovery.
Maybe that's not the best response to that.
So the discovery came from testing of the incorrect historical belief that a link existed between urea and mania.
Aha. Okay.
John Cade, the Australian physicist, took a somewhat unorthodox approach by collecting urine from patients and storing it in his own fridge to inject it into live guinea pigs. Over time, he began to inject uric acid using lithium urate, as it was so highly soluble. It's a lithium salt, and it caused the animals to relax. So Cade later tried it on himself for similar results.
We have a very urine-themed show tonight.
I'm
just going to point that out.
Cortisone. Cortisone is used to reduce inflammation, to treat pain, allergic, and skin disorders. Where did it come from?
So I'm pretty sure cortisone is a natural hormone. Is that right, Kelly? And so maybe it was used...
Cortisol.
Dang it. I know.
Cortisone, subsequent forms, was created out of a World War II rumor that German pilots were injecting steroid hormones to help counteract high-altitude stress. The myth spurred U.S. military to research their own compatible drug.
Huh.
How about that?
Huh.
How about... All right. I got two more.
All right. I'm going to get one of these.
All right. Warfarin.
Warfarin. What is it used for right now?
It's the most widely used anticoagulant in the world.
Anticoagulant.
Yes.
Okay. So, warfarin sounds like WARF, which is an institution at Madison.
That's correct.
Okay, so I'm pretty sure that I've heard that warfarin has to do with the UW.
That's correct.
And what would they use warfarin for back in the day at the UW?
Rat poisoning.
Oh.
It started off...
Of course.
Very briefly, it started off with this mystery of cows who experienced internal bleeding when they were fed an aged form of sweet clover.
Uh-huh.
They figured out what the chemical was that was extracted from the sweet clover that was causing it to happen, and it turned out that it was an anticoagulant, and they were basically bleeding to death. So then they thought, maybe this would make a great rat poison. So they patented that. And then it turned out to be a great treatment for heart disease. And it even helped save Dwight Eisenhower's life.
No kidding.
Correct. My name is Kelly Schwartz. I'm here with Kevin Lauderjung. This has been The Perpetual Notion Machine.
Space Invader blasting through the night. Tuning in that soul music on the satellite. All that low down funky rhythm.